Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Further from sobriety. Sobriety. Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Every day I'm moving further from sobriety.
And now it's time for Homegrown, your show on local art. The only show in Charlottesville dedicated to local art. Brought to you by the Blue Moon Diner here on 94.7 WPBC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, with your hosts, Leslie M. Scott Jones and David Von Strong. Now, here's David and Leslie. Hello, Charlottesville! This is Homegrown. It is Sunday, April the 2nd, the day after April Fool's. However, the joke on America is still being played. I am David Von Strawn, a.k.a. the Devious One. And with me, as always, is the lovely, the luscious, the lascivious, Leslie M. Scott Jones. Leslie. Yeah.
Oh, my. That was a lovely little introduction there, David.
Highly caffeinated. Never duplicated.
Oh,
David Von Strong.
Yes. Yes. I don't know if we could take a duplicated. Like, having two of you is that's a scary little thought is what that is.
It should not be in the world.
I mean, scary in a good way. I mean, you know, we have to figure out how to make it work.
It's like Highlander. There can only be one. Like, he would just be like getting more dates than me and more likes on Facebook. And
you're
I'd be
right.
Like, one's got to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
One's got
to
go.
That doppelganger would have to.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You
I understand.
Can't have, my duplicate can't have more swag than me.
Right.
That can't happen. Further, closer to Trump being in jail.
Well, let's hope.
Yeah. Well, if Michael Flynn makes the weekend,
right,
you know,
right.
They got dude on live.
You know, I actually saw a video on Facebook yesterday of a woman who was on the impeachment committee for Nixon. And she was talking about how that process went and what made them actually come to that conclusion and then compared and contrasted against what's going on with our idiot in the White House right now. And she was like, oh yeah, it's coming. She's like, it's a long process and there's a lot of moving parts to it. And there's a lot of things that have to happen, but she's like, yeah, everything that he did to be impeached, this one has done to be impeached.
Yeah,
so like,
history repeats itself. And it just goes to show that, like, you know, Nixon had the same, you know, bravado, the same, you know, insolence, like, how dare they, you know, question the president of the United States?
If I did it, it's legal because I'm the president. No, that's not how it works here, sweetie. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Crooks are everywhere. But let's go. Let's just keep going with the show. Let's talk more about art because we got a lot of nice guests. We got
we have three guests today.
Three guests, per our usual three guests in the month of March and April. That seems to be a thing going on now. But hey, we just gonna squeeze in all this art as much as possible because this is Charlottesville. We got too much art, so we got to bring on all these guests. All right. So our first guest is Michelle Kislyak of the McIntyre Department of Music, and they are celebrating their
20th anniversary.
Woohoo!
And it's a celebration with interactive music and dance. And so with that, I'm going to segue into the duration of the actual McIntyre Department of Music.
McIntyre.
I'm up north. Which is how long is the McIntyre Department of Music?
Existed.
Yes.
Oh, you'd have to ask. Well, you probably couldn't ask Thomas Jefferson because it was slightly after him.
I don't want to ask Thomas Jefferson
anything. I do not have that historical data.
Well, there's a lot of things that I want to ask Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, right? None of which
I don't
he wants
think
to
I would
answer.
Get the time to get to that question. But no. But actually, my question meant to be like actually your tenure with the University of Virginia. And you've been here for about...
Exactly. Well, okay. 20 and a half years.
So you would say that you're like the founder of this bad boy. Like you're the one to like put it on its legs and like give it a name and a face in the community. And
right.
You know,
well, certainly not the department, but the African Music and Dance
Absolutely.
Ensemble. Yes.
Because I'm sure there was music around, but it was just like a lot of people like Vic and Mozart, powdered wigs.
Oh, my God.
Maybe
David.
Some square dancing. Going, what?
There's no square dancing.
Well,
it's
there
Virginia.
Was.
I just imagine that, you know, at
no,
least during
David.
The Grover Cleveland administration.
Oh, my
like,
God.
Some presidential square dancing. Well, I'm just saying. So
I can't with you sometimes.
Michelle. Yes, I thought you were interviewing me. No, sorry.
I apologize.
No, I'm joking. No, there was the 1996 was the year that a department that was especially unusual for a music department made a big leap, and that was to hire two ethnomusicologists, myself and Kira Gaunt, who taught about a number of things, including hip hop. And also the origins of hip hop in girls clapping games and such. But she has since moved on, but I have stayed. And the department has gone on and on to the point where, last night we had a guest artist, Ninth Wonder, who was for a week the artist in residence. And So 20 years ago, there had not been an ensemble. They did have a winter course, a two-week winter course that Scott DeVoe invited a guest artist to do for a couple of years from Ghana. But once I arrived, I established the ongoing ensemble.
What inspired your love for African-American music, and why did you choose that specifically to bring to the forum of UVA? And why did you feel that it was important to do so?
One slight correction. So it's African music, and there's certainly a continuum through into African American music.
I apologize. I heard hip hop and.
Oh, right. No, I was just sort of expanding how the department sort of has opened up over time to the point, because actually a lot of music departments in the United States will have African music before African music, right, before they'll have African American music in terms of practical. Like they might have a course. They'll certainly have a course in jazz or blues, but not necessarily practical opening up. So so that's part of that process. But right. Well, I was exposed to African music as a college student. I had a professor who had just come back from doing his dissertation research in Ghana. That was at Tufts University, where I was lucky enough to go for free because my parents were on the faculty. So I jumped into that. And there, as I was trying to find my place, I heard this West African Eve music ensemble in their auditorium. And as soon as I heard it, and I was like, okay, that's for me. Grew up in Boston. I was interested in bluegrass and old time music because I was very interested in the ties between community, and social life and music really being fused. And, really bluegrass and old time was just as, distant for me as was African music, coming from a Jewish family in Boston. So both of those things, when I heard them, intrigued me, and I wanted to really immerse myself in them as far as I could. And my teacher, who was named David Locke, well, he still is named David Locke, who taught Eve music, also taught academic courses and exposed me to music from Central African rainforests, so the so-called pygmies. So when I heard that, that is yodeling polyphonic music that echoes through the rainforest trees. And their lifestyles is egalitarian, both gender and politically, sort of hierarchically egalitarian. They know how to live on the earth in a way that doesn't destroy it. I was like, oh, okay, if I can possibly learn about that, I'm going to try my best. So while I was studying West African Eve music, I made my way into graduate school in a department called Performance Studies at NYU that was sort of avant-garde intellectually and creatively. So it was a fusion of avant-garde arts and avant-garde thought that was just sort of coming to being in about 1982-83 at NYU. So that's where I pursued a doctorate in performance studies and went on to do research in the rainforests of the Central African Republic.
So how do you marry doing research about these people, about their culture, and then going into actually heading a department where it's performance based? Like how do you make that transition and make that work?
Great question. Well, I actually don't head the department, but I've been offered a space to do what I want, and really one of the central ideas of my research and my teaching is that you learn by participating. And that's something I learned from my teacher early on in college, that there are things that you cannot possibly understand unless you try to do it.
Yeah.
And the deeper you go into trying to do it, the more you understand.
Yeah.
And then you can actually relate to people on a level where they appreciate your understanding. Actually, anywhere you go in the world, if you understand the music that people say is their music, whether it's their popular music, you are already,
you have an in to understanding who they are. Yeah.
Right. And now they will trust that you are truly interested in them.
Yeah.
So also for teaching students, so many are not, they're sitting there with their books.
Right.
And I know how frustrated I was. It's like, okay, there's school and then there's real life. I'm like, no, that's not how it should be.
No, yeah.
Yeah, the two aren't mutually exclusive. Like, they should be, you know, intertwined. Yeah. I was going to ask about that, how I always felt that I learned quicker with hands-on experience rather than being taught about it. And when you hear with people with, you know, doctorates, you think that they're mostly about research and they don't really get their hands dirty and, like, get involved with, you know, the people that they're actually researching and experience. So, you know, just talk about, you know, expand on that, how you chose for that to, you know, for your study to not just be about research and more about, like, you know, the study of the actual people and, like, how they live and how they survive.
Right. Well, part of it is really taking a political stand that research should be mostly about people. And that's a shift that the field of ethnomusicology has made over the past, let's 20 or 30 years. It's a young field. It sort of grew up beside musicology, which had as its palette European art music mostly. And, of course, they have expanded since, too. But really, in ethnomusicology, the idea that your research was to learn with people, to learn how to play as well as you possibly could as an integral part. And some ethnomusicologists rose to the top of their performance field. You know, they were as good as the best in the areas they were researching. But for me, I was, just as I'd mentioned before, I was really interested in music and community and the fusion. So my research was about that fusion, not so much about virtuosity. And there is virtuosity in both of these genres that I have studied and teach. But it's really about what happens with the people through the music. So with the community that you make.
Wow.
So that's what this, that's what my teaching and performing is about.
Okay. So, I'm going to ask probably a prickly question, but I'm sure it's a question that you've gotten before.
Bring it on.
As a woman from North America who is Caucasian, how hard is it to get people to accept your appreciation and love of their culture without thinking that it is appropriation?
Wonderful question. Of course, I think about this a lot. There are really at least two sides to that, because one is the people you're learning from and one is the people you are teaching.
Right.
So the people I was learning from have no issue with it. Either in West Africa and Ghana or in Central African Republic, if you're an outsider, you're an outsider. It doesn't matter what color your skin is.
Right.
You're in a category.
Right.
Biaka people in the rainforest area are very open, gentle people. If they don't want to be around you, they'll just
walk away.
They'll become scarce. So if they think you're Sounds obnoxious, like you won't see them anymore. So... what I didn't have in that context was a precedent of someone coming in to learn. Whereas in West Africa, there are many, many foreigners who come in to learn,
mm-hmm.
say, Ghanaian dance through the Art Institute, through the National Dance Ensemble. In Central African Republic, and especially in the back of the rainforest, that they'd never seen anyone come in from the outside to learn their music and dance. So I had...
Right.
I had to learn their language, and then I had to explain to them that this is what I was doing. And for some, they could sort of plug me in and make sense, and some just never figured that out.
Right.
That's okay. So once, as we said before, once you're interested in people's music and dance, if they believe that you truly are, and that takes a while to show, they will trust you. And it's... And you can't fake that. You know, either you are or you're not. And it shows. Mm-hmm. So, but when it came to teaching, especially when I started out, that's different. In America, they're looking at me, it's like, hey, you're teaching an African music and dance ensemble, you don't look right.
Yeah.
Even though my first teacher was Caucasian, and I, you know, he was fantastic. I mean, really great player, great teacher. So I really didn't have any issue with his skin color, but I did think it was very important to talk about it.
Yeah.
And especially coming then here to Virginia, it's extremely important to the University of Virginia to talk about all of the issues of representation, appropriation, colonialism, neocolonialism, all of the politics that we're engaged in, and the immediate politics as well, such as we're dealing with right now. And in fact, right. So, but at first, people were suspicious. People didn't know me. I sometimes had people coming around to look at my class, and I didn't know who they were. It's like, who's this interloper coming in to teach African music?
Yeah.
Some of my earlier jobs in other states, it wasn't necessarily African American people that were skeptical. Sometimes it was, but it was, you know, white people are like, oh, you're not right, you're not
right.
And one of my first jobs, I was told, and this was by a Caucasian person who studied Chinese music, and she said, well, you know, I'm worried about your future because you're not black. And,
wow.
So, but it, in fact, you know, whatever position you're coming from is important to address and opens up interesting issues. So, whatever my skin color or my background, it would have opened up interesting issues. Our ensemble at UVA is mixed and it's different every semester. The ratio, right. One semester, for some reason, it was a lot of Korean men. I have no idea why that happened. Huh. But often there are students of West African background who've never studied the music and dance from where their parents come from or where they grew up.
Right.
And it brings people together in that way. And at UVA, there aren't that many contexts where people come together. So I have the most multicultural class on grounds.
This parallels the discussion with Andrea Douglas about the author of the photography book.
Yes.
From Darkness to Light.
Yeah.
She is a Caucasian woman, a photographer who compiled all of these stories, these pictures about, you know, the African American struggle for lack of, you know,
for the Underground Railroad. She literally traced the path of the Underground Railroad and photographed it.
So what I'm trying to get at is just that as long as somebody is telling our stories, we think that's the underlying important issue. And as long as people, you know, appreciate their place and, you know, their privilege in certain aspects, I think the more that we can make progress, I think the first step into solving a problem is admitting that there is one and not to sidestep any issues. So thank you for answering that question so concisely and candidly.
So what's part of the celebration? What are you putting on that we can come see?
Oh, please, yes. it's us. So because it's the 20-year anniversary, we decided to devote all of our budget to inviting alumni to come back and to join us. First, we'll gather just the alumni and the students in the class to have some food together out on the lawn if it doesn't rain, otherwise inside in the lobby of Old Cabell Hall. And I suppose people come early can get a little bit of that. But the public part of the event starts at 6 p.m. Mm-hmm. in the lobby of Old Cabell Hall, and we're sort of taking over all of the ground floor of Old Cabell Hall.
Oh, wow.
Because we'll continue dancing in the lobby, which we often do during rehearsal. And if it's nice enough, we'll do some of it outside as
well. So it says interactive. Can I Skype in? Can I get it on YouTube?
Now, this is the kind of interactive you kind of have to be there.
You have to be there,
David. It's actually interactive. It's not 2017 interactive.
No, right. It's not 2017.
You actually have to like be in presence.
So you're going to go dance, okay. David?
Maybe. How much is it? There's no cost?
It's free. There's no cost. Ooh. And you can be physically engaged as much as you want. So you can come and watch or you can come and join in. The challenge, and then we're going to descend into the hall, the concert hall, which we also is a challenge because it's very formal.
Yes.
So every time we perform in there, we have to transform it. So we're going to gather on the stage and then everyone else, however many people are, can gather them, can move around. They don't have to be stuck in seats.
Very cool.
But the challenge of this particular event, we always make it as community oriented and as inclusive as we can to to give people who want to join in moments to join in. But this one, because there's going to be a lot of alumni, we're going to be focusing on integrating the people from the past into the people of the present.
Yeah.
An audience who isn't part of that history can join in as they like. So it'll be a little more sort of inner-focused,
cool.
But everyone is invited, and there'll be ways to get to come in. But it won't be so much outer presentationally focused as we sometimes are.
Okay.
Which it'll be very interesting to see how that works.
That sounds cool. Fun. And when is this happening?
This is this coming Thursday, 6 p.m., Old Campbell Hall. Yeah, and
cool.
There should be parking available at that time.
Well, you know, I took a couple of African dance classes in college. Want to go dance?
Please come.
No. I want to see that on the VHS camcorder that it's recorded on.
It's not. There was no recording.
Oh, my God. April 6th, it's going down. Michelle Kislyuk of the McIntyre Department of Music. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right. All right. We're going to bring in our next guest. We're going to do a drop. We're going to be right back. This is Homegrown. Drop!
And we are back. It's, 22 minutes past the hour. You are listening to Homegrown. And if you haven't clicked in on our live feed in Facebook, what the heck is wrong with you? Because, you know, we're some beautiful people. I'm just saying.
Dagnabbit.
Yeah. Come on, people.
Get your keisters onto this.
No, you did not just say keister.
I did.
Oh, my God. Okay.
We keep it with the PG cursing.
We're good.
Here at
David,
Homegrown.
Who's our next guest?
Our next guest is Miss Patsy Asuncion. She is a poet. She leads the Poetry of Resistance, led by Annie Kim, and it's going on down to Charlottesville Writer House this afternoon from 1 to 4 p.m. How you doing,
He's
Pat?
Just making it up.
He is making it up.
That's
I know,
what I
right?
do. He's, I am an expert at BS.
He's just making it up as he goes along.
I have a BS
along.
In BS, actually. I have a PhD in BS.
Ba-dum-bum. Annie Kim is actually the instructor that's going to run the Poetry of Resistance.
But you're leading the marketing, the whole junket flow of... visiting all the radio stations. So I'm going to dig myself out of this hole.
No, like, I don't think you are.
No, I don't think so. I just don't think so.
See,
the
I'm telling
have
you.
Spoken.
She's the one I like.
The people
I like
have spoken.
Her.
All right, I'm going to shut up, Patsy. How about you do what you do? Tell me why you're here. Tell me what's going on.
I'm here because I want to promote Annie Kim's workshop, Poetry of Resistance, which happens this afternoon at Writer House from 1 to 4. For a few bucks, but it's worth it. It's absolutely worth it. And I'm here to talk about poetry of resistance, which is an important subject to me, especially in light of current politics.
Oh, yeah.
As it were.
Yeah.
So to speak. Anyway.
Politics.
Yeah. Annie is from UVA, and she was featured at the Virginia Festival of the Book is one of the fine writers for the Bridge Reading Series, which is, monthly Fridays. And she has a book out, Into the Cyclorama, which won the 2015 Michael Waters Poetry Prize.
What?
Woohoo! Yeah, and I'd like to read one of her poems, if I may.
That'd be great.
This one is called Aubad, from January of this year. Every day now we think the world is on fire. If only it would agree to be a handkerchief. We could stamp out in time to reggae music, cut a star from, or a snowflake singe with a long sulfurous match, or sail into a top-loading washing machine with all the ordinary white socks. Dream that when we open up the lid, it will be clean. Our children will be fed, our oceans not angry. Coal miners everywhere will walk into the sunlight. Blink. We'll pass around the wine and break the endless bread. Our words becoming almost beatific.
Ooh, nice.
Isn't that, she's something.
That's beautiful.
Yeah,
ooh,
yeah,
beatific.
Yeah.
Ooh, I love it. You know, I love when people use big words like that. I love seriously.
I also like when people use the phrase that the world is on fire, which is what I think
everywhere.
Every time I turn on the news.
So yeah. If you haven't caught on, David's got a little string of angry, which we love and appreciate.
Oh, I have no reason to be angry.
No,
absolutely not.
No, not you. No, but I love when poets mix. I don't want to say every day, but you know, colloquial metaphors with words that people may not know.
Right.
Because it kind of forces you to go, whoa, 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 what does that mean? Hold on. Google.
Yeah, but I think it almost, beatific is a word that it almost explains itself in context with this poem.
Yes.
And it stops you. It punches you in the face.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Or in the gut,
it almost
actually.
Makes you want to like look it up.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this: you've been a poet for quite some time and have been doing work like this for
yes,
quite some time.
Especially now.
Have you noticed an increase in the want to express poetry due to the climate that we are in politically and economically? Between colors and creeds, like, I've just noticed, a higher, like exponential, you could say, like increase in protest art and
absolutely,
and the want and the need to project it and for people to see it and for people to want to see it. So talk about that. Have you noticed an increase in...
I've noticed an increase in the market. It's hot now to have protest or resistance-type work.
I guess I'm speaking personally from your perspective, like people coming to you, DMing you, like, yo, I need to put this up. I need somebody to help me with this presentation.
Yes, yes. I think that people that are... let's call them fringe people, people on the fringe that are not mainstream, are finding a voice.
Pushed over the cliff, so to speak?
Yes. Well, no, I don't know if it's pushed over the cliff, but absolutely standing up on the edge and speaking up and finding a voice and finding the courage because it's urgent. It's globally, it's every ledge that people are standing out and saying enough and finding a voice. And I think poetry has always served that purpose. It's been a way for common folk to express themselves, especially politically. If you look back, you know, our whole spoken, our oral language, our history of speaking, our stories that we tell all came from the voice of the common person.
Yes.
Unfortunately, my bias now is that poetry has kind of been limited in the academic lane, so to speak, where common people are not...
they're not invited
as welcome,
in.
Yes, well, as welcomed. But now they're coming forth, and now different genders, different races, different politics are finding a place to speak, and people are listening.
Would you consider, you know, the music of Jimi Hendrix and Bob Dylan and Arlo Guthrie and those characters, would you consider that resistance poetry, in a sense? Or is that a different vein? And
No. I think that they absolutely hit on nerves back in the 60s, 50s, 60s for...
call to action, you know.
A call to action, but we're still in it, baby. It's not...
it's changed.
It's
like,
just not those...
changed. It hasn't been destroyed.
Yeah.
So you have a poem that you wrote.
Yes,
and
yes.
And we want to get to that.
Yes. I was honored and energized, I must say, to march in the Washington, D.C. March for Women. And out of that came this poem that happened to be picked up by the New York Times in January. So it was in the New York Times then. And it starts with an epigraph or a quote from Aeneas Nin.
Whom I love.
Life shrinks or expands in proportion to one's courage. The name of the poem is One. One ear hears another voice. One hand touches a stranger's. One foot follows more. One common trauma bubbles into one boiling effort. The masses in one scalded demise by the silvered spoons, every one. One emboldens one soft-spoken, who encourages one considered broken to come. One elder listens to one young, who brings one outed into the rung. One persuades her almond-eyed friend afar. That one wins over one slightly inky sister, who hooks one mixed-up stranger until one earthen vessel lifts us all as one.
Wow.
Thank you.
Hold on, let me push these goosebumps down
real quick. Right? I'm a little misty over here. I can see why the New York Times picked it up. Thank you so much for sharing that with us.
All right. I wish this could go on longer, quite honestly.
We need to have you back on the show when we have more time.
When we have more time, allowed for more guests. Patsy Asuncion, I will message you later. Thank you so much for being on the show.
And the workshop is today from 1 to 4 with...
Yes.
Annie Kim.
Charles Will
1
Writer
to 4
House.
Writer House.
Thank you so much, Patsy. Cool. All right, so we're moving on with the show. What's going on? Are we doing events? All right, here's what's happening this week. Here are just some of the artistic events happening here in Seaville now through April the 9th. Renaissance season at the American Shakespeare Center. This season features The Merchant of Venice and Coriolanus by Shakespeare and Sheridan School for Scandal. Emma Whipday's Shakespeare Sister, all playing at the Blackfriars Playhouse in Stanton. And through April the 8th, Shipwrecked in Entertainment, The Amazing Adventures of Louis de Rougemont, as told by himself by the UVA Drama Department in the Ruth Kaplan Theater. Now through the April the 30th is The Sky's the Limit, paintings by Jeanette Cohen, curated by former guest Leslie Vishaw. Just do Blue Moon. Blah, 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 blah. Artist events, Blue Moon. It's our place that we love. Breakfast all day, every day, with brunch on Saturdays and Sundays, and carefully constructed diner food on weekday afternoons and evenings. And speaking of evenings, Blue Moon is nice enough to provide a venue for local and visiting artists. This week, Wednesday, Jim Wave. Thursday, I Drop My Pick. Friday, Blues and Stuff. And that's at Blue Moon Diner at 512 West Main Street. Blue Moon Diner. It's a place. All right. So
we have the third one.
We have the third one. The third guest.
33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to 94.7 WPV. So this is Homegrown, show about local art. This is Clinton Johnston. I had to step in for a moment as Leslie steps out. Still here with the DVS-1. What's up, David?
How's it going?
And we are also here with our next guest, the Empress of Impresarios.
Do I get a crown and a sash?
I think you should.
And a scepter? I'm into that.
Coming back to the Homegrown airwaves from over the mountain, Carmel Clavin.
Hi.
You?
I'm good. Thanks for having me back.
Thank you for being back. So, how are things over the mountain?
They're a bit busy. You know, getting ready for the Shenandoah Fringe Festival.
Shenandoah Fringe Festival? Isn't that thing you did last year?
It is that thing I did last year, and we are speeding towards year two, and our overarching theme this year is, we are not other, we are of a kind.
Ooh.
I know, right? So last year was super successful. We're very happy about that. This year is even more amazing.
Right. So for people who don't know, Shenandoah Fringe Festival, last year, first year.
That's right.
1 year is a thing. It's an event. It's a blip. It's at the least an anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
Second year is proof of concept.
Third year is proof of sustainability.
Pray
for us.
So, how is Shen Fringe year two?
Shen Fringe year two is looking to be not much bigger, but really bad ass. I can't say that! what? Why, here I am.
You want to say badass? You can say ass.
Am I allowed to say that?
You can say ass.
All right. Year two is going to be pretty amazing. We've got a couple more shows than we did last year. No films this year, but lots more theater. And we've got some amazing visual artists and public artists.
Take a moment to remind people what the Shenandoah Fringe Festival is.
Oh, well, I'm so glad you asked, Clinton. So the Shenandoah Fringe Festival is a two-day confluence of the wild, wondrous, and weird. Inviting and beckoning our region's diverse makers and performers and patrons to present bold, curious, and risky work. So it is a, for lack of a simpler way of putting it, a performance arts festival that will be on a Sunday and a Monday. It is a curated profit-sharing event, so that means we believe that artwork is work and the arts economy is a force to be reckoned with, and that everyone should have access to it, that it shouldn't be a luxury good to go to the theater or to experience.
Or just art. Arbitrarily defundable by any general administration.
I wouldn't know what you're referring to, but I like that the where we are right now with that is it's raising a lot of tough questions, which I would love to ask about. If we're going to stop having a top-down reliance, we need to start talking about grassroots reliance and not trickle-down Reaganomics, which is the popular way of putting it. Like, oh, well, if the government defunds it, then rich people will fund it. And I'm like, actually, what we should be talking about is how everyone should now have access and agency to support the art, the performance, the film, the visual arts that they want to see, that they want to access, and that they want to connect to.
Okay, so here's the thing. We're looking to put together a panel of people to have a show, to have just this conversation. Do you want to come on?
I so do. When is it?
We're still planning it. We're still trying to gather our people.
Please, not Memorial Day weekend. I'm booked. But I would love to have that conversation. I think it's a really important conversation to have. I think it's taboo because it's about money, and in America, right, we don't like to talk about that. And I like to talk more about access and agency on the grassroots level. I think that this whole thing that we have found ourselves in as a culture is that we have things, gatekeepers deciding what is good, or tastemakers deciding what is good. And like, the internet was the first stage of like, well, screw that. We're going to do it this way. We're going to find a way around. And there's been a lot of ingenuity by artists to find a way to get their music and their art and their television and their zines around the gatekeepers. And I think the next level of that is in-person performance and what that means. And so the neo-burlesque movement, the neo-vaudeville movement is a huge part of that, of figuring that out and testing those waters. I'm just so excited to see where it's going to go.
Neo-vaudeville movement, of which you are a part.
I am.
Can I throw it out? I actually don't think that the internet was the first. Well, maybe the first. Can I throw something in which I think was a really big
part of it? I'm so excited. Tell me what it is.
iPod Shuffle.
Explain.
This is my thought. I think that iPod Shuffle was that one, having the iPods where you could have so much music in one place, so much music in one place, and then having a shuffle function really fundamentally changed the way we approached music. Because music had been, before that, for mostly economic and marketing terms, had been genreized, had been categorized.
I got that beat. Before that, there was the mixtape. You remember the mixtape?
I remember the mixtape.
Where you
waited for your favorite song to come on, and you hit that record button as soon as possible, and then you put that mixtape in your Walkman, and you put in your portable music system, and you carried along with you in the 80s. I think that was the first time. And there was actually like government bills that were used to like find some way to like stop selling blank tapes and things of media of that nature, so where people can record their information, because they said it was stealing from radio. You know, they said it was stealing from
recording
artists.
I remember this. It was like
nature.
You're allowed, the law says you're allowed to make one copy.
Yeah.
You're allowed to make one copy of something.
And they were doing everything in their power to take the power away from the people of creating their own music albums, you know, of the right. music that they specifically
their
like.
Own curations,
yeah.
really.
So and they were gatekeepers before then.
Oh, absolutely. I think the internet is part of that. I think the mixtape culture, I think zine culture, which was also around in the 70s and 80s. I think the underground house show yeah. movement of
Lampoon, heavy metal.
Yeah, of punk music, of rock music, yeah. of hip-hop. I think all of that is something that we need to start going, that analog style. We need to go back and be like, why did that work? Like, before okay. there was all of this sustainable, like, technology to make it so much easier. Like, how did that work?
Let's bring it back to Shenandoah Fringe Festival and how you actually got the funds and the means to actually
put
it up on your own.
I'm sorry, I had to stop myself from, like, laughing out loud when you said, how did you get the funds?
No, because, I mean, it was. I'm assuming that the funds came from... either your paycheck or what have you.
The funds came from my paychecks. So the Shenandoah Fringe Festival is produced by Spectacle and Mirth, which is my production company. And that...
dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. And that produces a couple of different projects, but the Fringe Festival is the largest one of those projects. So we do vaudeville cabarets. I keep saying we. You called me an empress, and now I'm going with the royal we.
Me and my minions.
Me and my minions. No.
That is my plan, to get you to fall into the royal we.
Wait, that sounds like a different game for a late night. So the Fringe Festival, produced by Spectacle and Mirth, is a gamble. It really is, because it is building the infrastructure in advance, hoping to God that people are going to come to the party.
Right.
And it's a curated profit share, so that means people apply. I make decisions with a couple of other people on a panel saying, like, what's going to be best for this situation? What logistically can we handle? And we try to keep it pretty diverse about the offering so that there's something for everybody. But also, then we create a package, a marketing package, and as much support as we can give to each of these people we've accepted to say, like, okay, we will help you produce this, but we need you to help us market it, to get the word out, to get to your people, so that we all succeed. Because we do a profit share, that means, like, if nobody comes to your show, nobody's making money. Like, right. you know, like, you don't make money and we don't make money, and that means that we don't get to do this again. So, right. yeah, so that, it is a gamble in the sense of, like, gee, I hope people show up.
People showed up last year.
They yeah. did.
But you bring a good point to it. How and I think as self-producers, as self-creators of artists, we kind of lose the idea that the marketer is there for us for their benefit. Mm-hmm. We're not begging somebody to put on our show. We're yeah. asking somebody to promote a really good show mm-hmm. that we have invested a lot of time in and we think deserves the attention. And it's like, yo, you need to get on the train and help me out with this, because if I don't get paid, you don't get paid.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people, I think a lot of self-artists like we kind of put it on our own backs and be like, oh, well, I got to make all these flyers. I have to put out this stuff. I have to do all of the marketing for me because I don't feel like anybody else is going to support me.
I think
me.
The hustle
you're still
is real.
Stung. You're still stung that I didn't hear about your stand-up show, did you?
No comment. Moving
oh,
forward. No,
but the thing. But
I'll lead on to that point, because as much as I appreciate verbal support from people, mm-hmm. you can, and you know, this is what I want to address to people, that okay, we remove all these gatekeepers. We've opened art to the individual and mm-hmm. the public. But you still got friends of yours that'll drop $100, $150 on a Beyonce ticket, but won't take the 10-minute trip to come out to see your Fringe Festival show.
Right.
That's
yeah.
like, what, $5 or $10? So how do you make
it's 10.
That...
It's $10, by the way.
It's 10. It's only 10.
All right, so it's only 10. So how do you make that point more salient? How do you express to your people, like, hey, we need to support more art in the local sense, because if it's not supported locally, then nationally it's not going to get the total respect and the total admiration that
for sure
deserves.
For sure. And there are two things that I like that are so my jam on this that I like, I'm so excited to be here to talk to you guys about. One is that, like, division of labor is what allowed us as human beings and to advance our cultures, like, 10,000 years ago when we stopped all having to do everything ourselves mm-hmm. all the time. Like, division of labor actually allowed us to do better work and to innovate and to move forward. Mm-hmm. So, like, let's just talk about that for a second.
Oh my god, people working together for a common cause.
What? Madness! The other thing is that, you know, the division of labor is, like, everybody needs to know about what's going on, but like, and the hustle is real, but like, you don't need to do every single piece of everything inside of your business or inside of your art, because you're just setting yourself up to collapse, you know? And even if you succeed, you might like, what kind of a victory is that?
Right.
So, and it's all you, it's all you. And like, I am one of these people who is feeling that right now, like having to make the decision about like, I think I need an assistant. And I have a lot of complex feelings about that. I have a lot of complex feelings about like feeling like I failed because I need help, that I have to ask somebody, but that it's important that another person learns what I am learning, that we work together towards something common. Like, there's a lot of complex feelings about this. But the other point is that artists specifically have been taught that they are stupid about business, that they are bad at math, that they are not understanding what it takes to get forward. But the thing is that
we are guilty here at the show of propagating that idea as well. Go ahead.
So the idea is to put that down, because that's a gatekeeper mentality of like, you don't do that.
You can't handle this.
But if you put that down and you start talking about agency and you start talking about education and you start talking about being proud of what it is that you're doing instead of like, please, can you come to my Fringe Festival? I think you might like it. Could you put up a poster in your shop? Yeah. So if we start talking more about it's not a zero-sum game. It's a raise all boats. It is everybody is winning because we're all building something that won't cannibalize itself. Yeah. It'll only feed itself.
In a larger sense, it's empowerment of community. And it lets people know that, hey, you have the power to change your community into the way that you want it to be and to fit the mold that you would like it to be.
And build the mold that you want to be. That there's an ecology to our localities, an ecology to our arts economies, and that they are intertwined. To think that they're separate, to think that, as someone who may have slashed some arts budgets recently said that entertainers are only there to make us smile, like, excuse me, but I think you are mistaken.
And think and emote and dream and be inspired.
Right.
But that's not important.
I have a theory that I'm working on for a show that's coming up, or a new show, hopefully, that's coming up, about how the chanteuse, the cabaret singer, is actually the modern and future equivalent of our bard. And the role of the person in the past who kept the stories of our humanity and our cultures from an oral tradition, that the cabaret singer is now the person who does that. So it's more about themes and less about specific epics, but that people come and gather within touching distance of a person who is singing their song.
47 minutes past the hour. If you're just tuning into us now, this is Homegrown, your show about local art. Actually, even if you're not tuning into us, this still remains Homegrown, your show about local art here on 94.7 WPVC.
But do we exist if no one is listening?
Oh, that's so not a question I'm courage enough to ask.
And there's no one around here.
We're sitting here, we're talking to Carmel Klavan from Spectacle and Mirth.
That's me.
And also from the Shenandoah Fringe Festival.
Uh-huh.
So, what are we looking at the Shenandoah Fringe Festival this time around?
Oh my God, so much. Or oh my snake God, as we say. So, James Taylor, our hostage of honor, is coming back this year. He is considered America's sideshow Sideshow historian. He's awesome. He's bringing his booksters and his cabinets of curiosities. We've got two shindigs just like last year on Sunday.
I heard James Taylor and I was like, oh, Fire and Rain. I love that song.
No. Like, way weirder. Way weirder. James Taylor of Baltimore. We've got two nights of shindigs on Sunday and Monday night as per usual. And again, yes, Sunday and Monday. That's right. Because if you work service or retail or hospitality, you don't get a Saturday and a Sunday.
Word.
What is a weekend? So we've got public art, and we've got a queerlesque cabaret show, and we've got shadow puppet shows, and we've got kid-friendly stuff, and we've got not kid-friendly stuff.
I'm guessing that's in the shadow puppet.
Yeah. We've got some really cool stuff, and
that's
we've got
not a snake.
So we've got Curtis Eller from Curtis Eller's American Circus coming up from North Carolina to perform with us. We've got a teacup cabaret. We've got the Stanton Liquid Light Society is going to be doing some stuff with us. Oh man, they're so weird.
So for the people that went to the initial
Fringe Festival. Is there anything new that you're bringing to the table that wasn't happening before?
So there's a large public art spectacle that's happening right in downtown called St. Simeon in the Sky, and it is about drawing attention to the homeless populations that are actually cool. in our area. And so one of our artists is building a 10-foot tall tower, and she's going to spend 24 straight hours on it. And it Whoa. Will... It, there's going to be some...
Are you saying there's an old-fashioned... Tower sit?
There's an old-fashioned tower sit with some singing and some dancing and some interaction. And, you know, it also has a message other than self-indulgent artist behavior. So that's pretty awesome. There's some really, really, really great stuff coming this year. I'm very excited.
Any acts from Charlottesville?
No.
Oh, Charlottesville not representing.
Again. Fire in the Belly Dance Company will be there, but they are not technically of Charlottesville.
I know.
It's the closest you've got,
it's
though.
Close, give us the what, the where, the when once again so people know.
The Shenandoah Fringe Festival will be on April 9th and 10th, a Sunday and a Monday, starting at 11 a.m. and going to the wee hours of the night. And you can find tickets and more information about shows at www.shenfringe.com.
Shenfringe.com!
Be there or be sad.
Like on Facebook, also, on Twitter, on Tumblr, on...
All the places.
All
and
the places.
Hashtag Tumblr. We are not other. Hashtag Shenfringe.
Carmel Clavin, thank you so much for returning to the show.
I love being here. Thanks, guys.
Looking forward to next year for Proof of Sustainability.
Yay!
Hey, Charlottesville, this is Greg Brown, and you're listening to Homegrown 94.7.
Support today is coming from Integral Yoga, the area's independent, local, natural food store serving the area since 1975 with natural foods, body care products, and supplements. Integral Yoga now has new store hours starting at 8 a.m. You can stop in before work for a customizable smoothie made with 100% organic ingredients and no added sugar or ice filler. Integral Yoga is at 923 Preston Avenue, now open 8 till 8 Monday through Friday, 9 till 8 Saturday, and 11 till 6 Sunday. And all the time at iyfoods.com. That's Integral Yoga Natural Foods.
Hey, it's 53 minutes past the hour, and if you're just tuning in, you missed out on Homegrown 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're about to wrap this bad boy up. First things first, just want to thank our guests, Michelle Kislyak, Patsy Asuncion, and Carmel Clavin. Coming up next is the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call with your host, Sean McCorn. Their guest is Meredith Richards of the Road Forward PAC, talking about understanding the government forum. Thank you, but now is Leslie's weekly rant.
I have no words. No, let me rephrase that. I have no socially acceptable words for the absurdly misguided woman named Rachel Dolezal. I had hoped that we would be able to forget about her particular brand of crazy after she was exposed and got fired from the NAACP in Spokane, Washington. For those of you who don't remember, and believe me, I've tried to forget, this is the woman who perpetrated a fraud. She pretended to be a black woman. She taught African studies at a local university. She was married to a black man. She did all of this saying that she was black. She recently changed her name to a combination of African names from two different tribes' languages, further mutilating the culture she says she loves. She also recently said that she got divorced because she was too black for her husband, and did all of this teaching other people about blackness and making decisions as president of a major black social organization on behalf of a group of people that she can't possibly understand. For those of you who think that this petulant child doesn't pose any threat or cause any real harm, let me explain it to you. It is the epitome of white privilege to believe that simply because you have affection or appreciation for a culture different from your own, that it is perfectly okay to appropriate it. It is lunacy to then build a life around this fallacy and expect that, one, it would never be discovered, and two, that the rest of the world would simply go along with your delusion simply because you did such a good job creating it. And that's what this woman is, a lunatic. So what's the threat? How could this woman, who is obviously deranged and in need of psychological help, derail the civil rights movement? How could she hurt any strides we could make? Very easily. The civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s succeeded not because of the strength of one man. It succeeded because of the hard work of thousands of people, all working toward one cause with one voice. It made inroads into the political arena through allies, white allies that put political pressure on the right people at the right time to bring about social change. And yes, there were speeches and rallies and smaller branches of several organizations, all organized and run by and for people of color. But let's not be stupid. None of it would have been successful if not for the powerful and right-minded white people who made it impossible for the people who couldn't have cared less that we were in pain, that we were dying, that we were starving for food and craving knowledge, to ignore us. It started with a very intelligent black man, beyond reproach, befriending white men who convinced others to make those changes and make them law. And if you think the reputation of which black person does the speaking doesn't matter anymore, let me remind you that our president's press secretary and a supposed journalist have just degraded two very well-spoken and accomplished black women on television just this week. It matters. And it should matter. I want the person speaking for my rights in those rooms behind closed doors to be the most intelligent, well-rounded, unshakable debaters on the planet. I also want them to be black. I want them to look like me, be like me, so I know that they have the kind of understanding of what it means to be a person of color from the only lens that matters when you're talking about social justice and equity. We are in the room now. We don't have to be invited in by a white person. We have our chance to be at the table instead of being the main course. Now, I'm not saying that if Rosa Parks had a drug problem, we would still be in the back of the bus. What I am saying is that we would have been there longer and it would have been harder to win the fight. Why would we want to make it harder for ourselves? And as for Rachel Dolezal, who cries in the media about how her life has been ruined and how we should feel sorry for her because no one else accepted her delusion. Honey, you ain't special. You ain't black. You do not speak for me or any other black or brown person I know. And I can tell it's getting harder to keep up because, Precious, the only person who would fix they mouth to say they were blacker than a black man is a white woman. Baby, check your watch, because your 15 minutes was up 15 minutes ago.
And that was, in case you didn't know, in case you couldn't tell, Leslie's Weekly Rant. That's all we have for Homegrown this week. Once again, I'd like to thank our guests, Michelle Kislyuk, Patsy Asuncion, and Carmel Clavin. Coming up next, it's a Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call with Sean McCord, Meredith Richards from Road Forward PAC, talking about the Understanding Government Forum that's coming up. Homegrown, your only show about dedicated local art in Charlottesville with your hosts, Leslie M. Scott Jones, David Von Strong. We'll be back next week. We'll be black next week. Who knows who you'll be?
Listening to Homegrown on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. You can contact the show on Facebook by searching Homegrown Charlottesville. Be sure to tune in again next Sunday at 10 for Homegrown, only on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.